The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
You're listening to Business is Boring, a podcast that reckons it's anything but. Business is Boring is brought to you by Spark Lab, offering inspiration and practical advice to help businesses find their edge. To hear more about Spark Lab, including details about the latest events, workshops, and business tools, visit sparklab.co.nz. And now, here's your host, Simon Pound.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Welcome to Business is Boring. You might have seen in the news recently that Australasian VC Blackbird took part in a record-setting sell-down of shares in the company Canva, netting something like $800 million. Blackbird have been a VC active in the New Zealand scene for over 4 years, and they announced this week that partner Phoebe Harrop is going to be taking over the lead duties in New Zealand from Sam Wong. Joining us to talk what a VC does, what Blackbird's all about, and what's next, we're delighted to have Phoebe in the studio now. Tanakwe, thank you for being here.
Kia ora, Simon. Great to be here.
Hey, so your journey into Blackbird is a really cool one from the world of consulting at one of the world's premier consulting kind of shops, and then into investing in kind of things for a better world with some big names. Tell us how you first got interested in the world of getting into companies and making things happen.
Yeah, maybe I can take you all the way back to New Plymouth in the mid-2000s.
Yes.
So I suppose I was a real nerd at school. I loved everything from Spanish to art history to genetics and everything in between. And I really struggled to know what should I do with my life? How could I pick one thing? I remember going to see the movie An Inconvenient Truth when I was 15 at Top Down Cinema 5 in New Plymouth. And that really struck a chord with me, the idea that, you know, climate change was going to be one of the biggest problems for my generation to try and solve. And that certainly sat with me as a problem I was interested in working on. But I was interested in so much: healthcare, education, and it was difficult to choose. So when it came to time to kind of decide what to do after school, I did the classic thing of, all right, small town, what do people in small towns do? If they're successful, they're teachers, doctors, lawyers, accountants, maybe an engineer if you're in New Plymouth. And I chose law because it seemed like the most generalist option. It didn't narrow me down in any way. And I felt that law was going to be this amazing tool to make positive change on all those issues. I went to law school and absolutely loved it, but by the end of it, I realized that law is not the best way to make positive change. Like, as a lawyer, you're often the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. You're trying to sort things out after a mess has been created, and it's really not a great way to make positive impact going forward.
Yeah, like you watch Erin Brockovich and think that you're going to be able to crusade, and then third year in law school, you go and see what it's like to actually work at a big firm, and you're like, oh my word, that looks like a Terry Gilliam dystopian hellscape.
No comment. And so when it came, yeah, sort of like, I was there in my last year of law school, and I heard about consulting as an idea. And this was, you know, I'd never thought about business as a career. It wasn't, you know, the businesses that I was familiar with growing up in New Plymouth were accounting firms, hairdressers, you know, a car yard, this kind of thing. There was nothing in the way of technology startups. Mm. There were certainly few women leaders, and I hadn't really considered business at all. But as I learned a bit more about consulting, Bain, where I went on to work, came and recruited at Otago for the first time that year. I went along to the info session, and I heard, you know, opportunities to travel, new kinds of ways of thinking, like quantitative skill sets, as well as the legal stuff, legal thinking that I'd been learning, better salaries. This is an Australian job. I was really interested. And so I applied and managed to get a graduate position at Bain. So I would say it was an amazing ticket out of New Zealand and into a completely different world, but it wasn't something that I knew much about, to be honest. And that was really my first step into business and understanding how private companies, private enterprise can affect a lot of change and actually holds a lot of the reins of power in the world and a means of sort of trying to school up in those centers of power and trying to have influence through business.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Like, I absolutely love that. Like, the whole kind of reason this podcast started is that, yeah, like, there's this view that business is just some kind of administrative role as like something, you know, business news was like accountants turning into, you know, politicians turning into directors or whatever, very, very dry, very grey, very numbersy. And then from getting into the world of business, I saw how creative and interesting and fun it was and did feel like it was a shame that I'd never seen that business could be creative. And like, consulting is at the absolute pointy end of that, right? So what is consulting for people who might have heard about consultants? And like, this is the kind of thing like McKinsey or Bain, they're two of the big names there. What do you actually do?
So Bain works at the big end of town. So if you're a really large, probably listed company, some of the clients I worked for would be like Coca-Cola, Lego, Westpac, these kinds of companies. If you have a big problem in your business and you want some outside expertise, often just an outside person to pin some blame on, but let's say expertise, and you know, a brain's trust to bring some external perspectives, offer you new information that you might not have as a business yourself, and kind of be a force for change, that's when you bring in the consultant. So I worked for Bain for 3.5 years, first in Melbourne, and then I went to London with Bain. And the kinds of projects I was working on, if you take Coca-Cola, for example, they have one company that owns the brand, does all the marketing for Coca-Cola, and then they have all these partners who actually make the drinks, distribute them, and have the retail interface. And so the project there was working on a joined up marketing strategy between the bottler and the brand owner. Another example would be Lego. I spent 4 months of my life commuting from London to Billund, which is Denmark's 100th biggest town. It has 3 restaurants and 1 hotel, the Lego Hotel.
Cool.
Where you stay in a themed room, Ninjago, Princess, etc. I spent 4 months of my life commuting there doing headcount reduction. So taking their whole org structure, redesigning it so that it was 10% smaller in collaboration with people whose jobs might be on the line. That was a really weird, quite stressful, very strange experience. But, you know, it's stood me in good stead, honestly, to understand, you know, many businesses are different. There are many kinds of business, but they have very common problems. It's usually people related, customer related, you know, production, supply chain, operations related, and those learnings can be applied to, you know, even tiny startups. So I often come back to all the things I learned at Bain in board meetings and working with startups now. The thing that it's good for is teaching you sort of general frameworks for how to think about problems, where to go looking for information, how to break things down and understand what's important and what to focus on. And those are skills that seem to me totally second nature now. And I think the legal training actually helped with that a lot too. But things that seem common sense to me are not necessarily common sense to other people. So I'm really grateful for that training. It was a very intense type of work. We'd typically work 80 hours a week, something like that, often with that travel. And I looked kind of further into the future to what the life of a Bain partner would be. And it just wasn't something that the kind of lifestyle that I wanted. And I wanted to be probably closer to the action as well. And working with more dynamic technology-driven companies rather than these very influential but slow-moving beasts.
It is remarkable, consulting, in that there are very few ways that people young in their career, early in their career, can be at a macro level. Because if you go into a company, then you have to own your, you know, piece within the bigger machine and do really well in that. But to actually be exposed to, you know, future trends that will shape whether this is a good business line to stay in, the absolute full picture of costs going in and profits coming out, and to be listened to and be a person having to advise very senior people who've gone down a traditional path. So you've got to, what, like, learn the whole shape of the world, but also learn those skills to be able to convince and sell ideas through, right?
Yeah, it's a real recipe for imposter syndrome, I'll tell you, because you're sort of like 24 years old and CEO of Lego is saying like, who are you and why do you know anything about this? And on some level, but you're right, it definitely gives you, I think what I learned from it is that everyone has a valid contribution to make. And if you listen and you really think about something and can share your views, then they are worthwhile. So in some ways, it probably was a real confidence builder as well as being challenging on the confidence front.
Yeah, and learning how to make like an ironclad case, right? Mm. Like mm-hmm. really having to back it up.
With data, which is obviously different to the legal stuff that I'd done at uni. But
yeah, it's so cool. And there is like a bit of a kind of idea that in many cases, people call in the consultants because they know they need to do the headcounts and they want to be able to point to someone uh-huh. else's report as to why they did it, because it's emotionally and difficult for people. And that's like one use case, right? Mm. But there's also kind of outside thinking to help people navigate the future with very big and slow moving things, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is really exciting work as well. And I think, as you say, it's actually a privilege because you're working with people who know their business so deeply, who might be 30 years older than you, mm. and they're paying a lot of money for you to be there. So it was an incredible business training. 3 years was about the right length. Yeah. And then maybe just to bridge, because I want to come back to your original question. So I got to do a fair bit of private equity advisory at Bain. So this mm-hmm. is when big private equity funds would come with an idea like, we're thinking of buying the Body Shop. Should we buy the Body Shop? And we'd do a month's worth of really intense work to talk to the Body Shop customers, understand their supply chains, decide whether this was a good company to buy. And then that private equity fund would potentially go and bid for that, maybe buy it, maybe not. Next month, you'd be onto something else, dental mm-hmm. clinics or, you know, industrial cleaning machines. And I love that way of thinking of bringing a kind of common toolkit, going really deep on an industry and on a company, and then coming to a decision and moving on and looking at something else.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to work for any of the clients that we were serving. These were very male-dominated, large-cap private equity funds who had this attitude of, you would go in, buy a majority of a company, and then you'd swap out the management, you'd lever it up with a bunch of debt, try and sell it again to probably some other private equity fund. And it didn't seem to me that they were always creating value, net value in the world.
Yeah.
And that's what led me to Generation, which is Al Gore's investment firm. So I joined there after 3 years in London. And yeah, we can talk about that.
Oh, isn't that cool to go for that that full arc from watching An Inconvenient Truth to then joining the firm that he's part of? So tell us about that. As you know, people who are in the world of FMCG mm. and cool food brands will know Nature's Find, which is a absolutely extraordinarily cool fungi-based alternate kind of yogurt, etc. company with really cool branding in a space that was very utilitarian. And that was one of the companies you invested in there. Mm. And when I saw that, I was like, how cool to have been at the front of that.
It's so cool that you know that brand. I didn't realize it was famous. In my mind, you know, it's something I don't come across in New Zealand, of course. So anyway, interesting that you knew that one. Yeah, so let me tell you a bit about Generation. So Generation was started by Al Gore and David Blood, who was the head of Goldman Sachs Asset Management Worldwide back in about 2002. And at that time, they had this thesis that if you look not just at what a business does, but how it's run, how it manages its supply chain, whether it's a sort of net positive impact business on the world, you could have alpha. You could make positive returns above the market average by focusing on these non-financial aspects. This sounds completely normal now, right? Have you heard of ESG? But then it was completely novel. And so they started just with public equity, so just investing in public companies, only looking for the highest quality public companies in the world. And that strategy did extremely well. I joined Generation in the growth equity team. So this is a team that was investing in later stage startups. Typically, they'd be raising a Series C or a Series D. We'd invest $50 to $100 million US in those rounds. And they were businesses that were in some way impacting the sustainable development goals. So Nature's Find, who you mentioned, they're an alternative protein company, definitely help with resource utilization compared to meat products. But it spanned things like enterprise efficiency. So a company called Asana, which is kind of workflow management, task management software, was one of our investments.
Monday before Monday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Through to electric mobility, a company called Gogoro, which does electric scooters, like the electric mopeds in Taiwan. So a wide range of companies. And that was an incredible investing education because I'd gone from being a consultant where we were sort of doing half the investing job of looking really deeply at a company in a market, but usually very disconnected from the people that were running a company. And that's something that became much more of my focus at Generation. And then the actual business of putting millions of dollars into a company, working with founders, sitting on boards, raising funds as an investor, and all that jazz. So I was really privileged to have that experience. That was 3 years in London. But about half of our portfolio was in the US. And I got to work pretty closely with Al as well.
Cool.
He was amazing because if we wanted to talk to a CEO or a founder, we could cold message them on LinkedIn and say, hey, do you want to have dinner with Al Gore?
Yeah.
And pretty much everyone, except, you know, maybe 10% of people who are hardcore Republicans, pretty much everyone would answer that call. And so we got to bring together these amazing groups of people. Al had this incredible convening power, and that really got us into situations and deals that we probably didn't deserve to be in. So, he's an interesting fellow.
History is going to be so much kinder to Al Gore than the media and the world have been over the last 20 years.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I have a lot of respect for him because he travels something like 320 days a year. He's constantly on the road, splits his time between upskilling communities in climate advocacy and making investments through Generation and climate positive businesses. And there's a whole other strategy called Just Climate, which is very carbon emissions focused, which kind of grew up after I left Generation. And yeah, he's an incredibly smart person. You can give him talk about some genetics topic or something. 5 minutes later, he's parroting it to a room of 100 people as if he knows the topic deeply. And, and so you're like, gosh, I hope what I said was right.
That's so cool. And that move in to want to build things as well, because I guess, you know, it's almost like consulting seems to me to be almost like doing an MBA, except instead of studying case studies, you actually do the case studies. And then actually investing and being part of building companies is a different kind of game, right? Like you've got the interpersonal, the people side of things. And then personally, yeah, do you find it like that kind of element really meaningful building things?
Yeah, when I interviewed at Generation, Anthony, someone who'd gone to be a real mentor of mine, said, well, at Bain, you've been doing a lot of dating companies. Are you ready to get married? And it really is like that. So especially the work I'm doing now at Blackbird, where we're investing, often we're the first investors that founders have taken money from at all. And we know that we're on a 10, 15, hopefully 20-year journey where we are a meaningful investor for them all the way along. That is a little bit like getting married. Probably the average marriage doesn't even last that long.
Mm.
And so it certainly is meaningful. And the relationship with people is sort of first and foremost in early stage investing. And I suppose I've been coming closer and closer to that through these different career experiences, from very arm's length, very cerebral and technical at Bain, to more people focused, but still very analytical at Generation. Now to very early stage, very much focused on people. It's being an early stage venture capital investor is more like being a sports coach than anything else.
Yeah, if that's fair. I'd love to come back to that in a second. Like, really interesting to go from the industry level to the, you know, company level to the founding team level, but having those frameworks and knowing those things. Tell us what brought you back to New Zealand and Blackbird as it sounds pretty cool working at London on like investing in the absolute future of things with like a really, really cool big company.
The thing about investing, as I said, it is very long-term orientated. So when you get to, you have to make a decision at some point as to where you want to put down your roots, because every year that you spend in an ecosystem, you really get these compounding benefits where you know all the players, you've got good relationships, hopefully, and you're following these stories of founders as they unfold. And so it's a big call to move from one investing job to another, and especially one geography to another, and another one asset class to another. And so I was at this point where I was starting to get senior at Generation, but I had kind of, it was a litmus test moment of, am I going to be committing to London or San Francisco for the next 10, 15 years or not? And it was 2020. I was in COVID lockdown in London. I'd just broken up with my Aussie partner of 6 years, and I had this blank sheet of paper in front of me. And I think COVID really was a moment of truth for a lot of people in different ways in their life, and it certainly was for me. And I think looking at that blank sheet of paper, I really felt like I want to be back closer to family. And so I sneakily took the New Zealand summer to go back from London to New Zealand. I was still working for Generation, getting up at 4 a.m. to join the, San Francisco hours. But at the same time, having a look around to see what was happening in New Zealand, to see if there was a place for me here. I'd come across Blackbird a few years before. There were a couple of later stage portfolio companies that Blackbird had, like Safety Culture and Culture Amp, that were interesting candidates for Generation. And so I'd kind of been stalking those people, chatting to Nick and Rick, who are a couple of the partners. And I'd also, while I was in London, volunteered for the Startmate Women's Fellowship, which is a program run by Blackbird's sister company, Startmate, that tries to get women from other walks of life, journalism, medicine, law, into startups through showing them what different roles are. And I'd been a mentor in that program from London with a London-based mentee. And so I kind of was a little bit in touching the ecosystem already from there. And I was just amazed by the energy that kind of came out even from London. The amount of goodwill, people giving up their time to mentor others into the space, and this sort of sense of energy that was coming from Australia and New Zealand. So I came back to New Zealand. I had been chatting to Sam on Zoom. And then after a couple of walks around Auckland Art Gallery, pushing her daughter Ava in the stroller and attending the two-person Blackbird Aotearoa Christmas party, I was lucky enough to get a job as an associate in New Zealand. And that was really a sort of right time, right place, serendipitous moment of being able to join the team when there was a little bit of space for me, and at a time when Sam had moved to New Zealand only probably a year prior. She'd raised a $60 million fund just to invest in Kiwi founders, and there was a chance to grow the team that I slipped into. Another part of history that you might not know is Connor did try and recruit me for Previously Unavailable.
Yeah, great. Good boy. Good man.
But I was very interested in Blackbird and, a big fan of theirs already. So that was probably the best decision I've ever made.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And tell us so you came in as an associate. Like, I think a lot of people like venture capital, it's probably like consulting. People have some pictures in their head of, consulting, it's probably lots of planes and spreadsheets and 2 a.m. finishes and those little boxes of Chinese food.
That's pretty accurate, Simon.
And then older people being grumpy with you. VC, there's probably, very strong kind of like cultural things that people have in their head about it all. What does a VC do? And if you're coming in as an associate and then you go to be a partner and then what do you do across those times?
Well, there are basically five activities that you do whether you're an associate or a partner, and the balance of how you spend your time shifts. So the first is finding companies to invest in. The second is selecting them. So we meet, for every 100 companies I meet, I'll invest in one or two. So there's that selection funneling phase.
Are you really careful about who you meet as well?
Yes. Let's say for every 100 companies that gets in touch or I meet. Yeah. So first you've got to find them. Then you've got to pick which investments you're going to invest in. Then you've got to win the deal. You've got to win the right to invest. Not always straightforward. Then you make the investment and you work with companies after investment. You might be sitting on their board or certainly meeting with the founders very regularly to try and help them work through business problems, bring resources to bear on those problems. And then possibly most importantly, you have to fundraise. So every couple of years, we go out just the same way that our founders go out, and we raise funds that we can then go and invest. And we can get into talking about that if you like. The sixth limb is probably building a team, so building the actual business of Blackbird. And as I think about how my job's changed, as an associate, your job is really to be out in the community, hustling, meeting a lot of founders, helping take first meetings and sort of learning the, tuning your own algorithm for selection, building relationships with those founders, and then supporting on the analysis that you need to do to the extent you can analyze anything, but at least understanding the people, the idea, the ambition in the selection phase. And in terms of the post-deal support, post-investment support and fundraising, that's less of your focus as an associate or a principal, which is a role that we have in between. And now I'm spending more time on the business of growing Blackbird and growing the team here.
And we'll be back in a moment to dig into what makes a good VC investment, what makes a good founder, the state of VC here, and what's next. Spark is proud to partner with the Sustainable Business Network and the Climate Action Toolbox. The free Climate Action Toolbox can provide you with simple step-by-step guides to measure and reduce your emissions. Help lead the way to a low-carbon future for New Zealand. Visit sparklab.co.nz/sustainability to find out more.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Welcome back to Business is Boring, where we're with Phoebe Harrop of Blackbird Aotearoa. So, what does make a good VC investment? Because I read this great piece that you have on the Blackbird blog about how, kind of making a bit of a link to the dating type nature of courting companies and deciding whether to get married to them. And you go into some really lovely detail about, like what you look for in a company and why VC is not right for the vast majority of companies. Should we start there? Like, I think that's really fascinating because a lot of people probably think that putting out a press release with a great name VC backing them with a big check is success. But actually, if you're not the exact right type of company, it's just the beginning of your problems, right?
Totally. Yeah, so maybe I can try and explain how we look at a company that comes through the door. So our strategy at Blackbird is to invest in generational companies right at the very beginning. So we're looking for companies that can become the next Canva, as an example. So Canva's valued at $38 billion, Australian dollars at the moment. And they're a company that's doubling revenue, yet they're making $2 billion of revenue per year. So it's just this behemoth of a company that's absolutely up there with the best companies in the world in terms of size, scale, and influence. And it was fully built in Sydney. So my job at Blackbird is to find the probably 1, 2, 3 generational companies that are born in New Zealand or born from Kiwi founders each year. And every time we make an investment, and we only make probably 3 or 5 investments in New Zealand each year, we have to see a path to that company becoming a billion-dollar plus company. And the reason is that we raise these funds and we know that over a 2-3 year period when we're investing that fund, there probably will only be 1 or 2 companies that really succeed. The rest will not return any money to the fund. And so the ones that succeed have to really, really knock it out of the park. Otherwise, we don't make money for our investors. And so Canva is a real standout, but for context, that in the first investment that Blackbird made in Canva in 2013, that investment has returned 2,600 times what it was worth to investors, and that was in the secondary sale that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago. And so every company that comes through the door, we have to imagine at least a path to, you know, $1 billion plus valuation. And there are certain business models that allow you to get to that scale of company within a sort of 10-year time frame. They tend to be really unique in terms of the technology that they have. They tend to have high gross margins. So if you have a product that no one else has, you can charge a lot for it. That usually gives you a nice gross margin, which you can then go and invest in further growth. They tend to be solving really significant global problems, not just ones focused on New Zealand. They tend to be in markets where you can grow your customers very fast. So there are some industries like highly regulated fintech, or selling perhaps to government predominantly, where it's just really, it's a real slog to grow fast. And so those are some pretty general criteria, but they do help narrow down what's an appropriate fit. The other things we're really looking for are personal ambition on behalf of the founders. So as I mentioned, we're kind of often investing when there may not even be a product. Maybe the product is just in market with a few customers. The team may be 2, 6, 10 people. And so what we're really looking to understand is why are these people building this company? What's driving them? Is this their life's work? Have they landed on some secret that other people haven't uncovered because of their previous life experiences? Do they have what it takes to build the product? Have they got technical experience? Can they build something that's really different and really differentiated so that they can attract amazing talent, attract more capital down the track? Because if you want to be a billion-dollar company, you're going to have 5, 6, 7, 8 rounds of venture capital in your future. Are these people amazing storytellers? Can they explain a complex product to customers and to investors? These are the kinds of things that we're looking for.
And there are so many things, right? There's that great kind of like truth that there's a million ways to fail, but only kind of a very few to succeed. And so many things have to go right, which I guess is why even if you're seeing the best deals, because, you know, for context, Blackbird is by a very good margin the largest Australasian venture capital fund, and probably the most active and energetic in the community, right? So you're seeing the best deals, but you still expect a good half of them not to go anywhere because of the risk factor involved in so many things having to go right when you're making something new that's never existed.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about Blackbird and is different to Generation, which Generation came from this kind of, it's almost a hedge fund, so it's very secretive, risk averse, more regulated space. And Blackbird is the opposite of that. So we're a very risk tolerant culture. We know that, yeah, let's say 60, even actually the best VC funds have a higher loss ratio, but also a much higher win ratio. So you have to be very risk tolerant. You have to be willing to make investments, not hold back and not make investments. And so we have a really healthy team culture about supporting the making of investments rather than, you know, being too risk averse, let's say. The worst thing you can do is miss the generational company that was in front of you. It's better to make more bad investments and make a few good ones.
That's so interesting. And so much of it when you're at that early stage, because I mean, we've seen a bit of that with some of the really big operators, the Tigers and the like, you know, big international VC firms, started almost doing an index kind of approach where they'd pop, you know, a couple $100,000 or $1 million in every deal going anywhere just to get optionality to then invest in the future. And they'd do it at valuations that kind of blew up reality for quite a few companies and probably caused some troubles later on. Mm. But that's also not a good thing to do, right? So you've got to get the balance between putting a buck into everything because of time, energy, ability to actually be part of, and spreading wide enough to not miss the good things.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe just going back to the maths, we will probably invest in 20 companies, let's say, out of a fund. Each one of those, we've got an $80 million fund for Kiwi founders. Each one of those 20 positions, when we invest, we have to imagine, okay, let's say we invest $2 million and we get 10% of a company that's at seed or series A. We have to imagine that our 10% slot of that company in 8-10 years' time is going to be worth more than $80 million New Zealand dollars. So that if only one company succeeds, we can still return money to investors. Ideally, it's 2 or 3, and ideally they succeed many multiples of that. But we know we're working with a power law distribution here where there probably are 2 or 3 companies out of 20 that'll really succeed. And so we think a lot about trying to do fewer deep investments in hopefully companies we think are going to succeed so that we can make our funds successful. Because if our funds aren't successful, we don't have a right to exist. And honestly, we also threaten the ability of Kiwi companies to have early stage capital. There aren't many VC funds in New Zealand. If we don't perform, our industry won't get more money, and that would be a massive shame for Kiwi companies.
Yeah. Just to jump into that kind of really interesting point you just made about creating the environment where it's safe to have failures. It's so hard, right? Like, because reputation is part of what drives the good founders in the door, and the funders and people who are generally the investors in your funds are people in charge of very big pools of money, and they are probably the most famously risk-averse type of people that exist. And so, yeah, being able to have this environment where you can go, hey, there's 10 things we're investing in, they all look a little bit bananas because you don't actually change the future without being a bit bananas. And three of them are probably going to die spectacularly and then keep everyone's confidence and comfort the whole way through. Seems to me to be a very interesting thing to have to achieve.
Yeah, and I think I'm lucky to work at Blackbird where there are 12 years of track record there. And the recent sale of Canva shares is really meaningful for the whole ecosystem because it proves that you can actually return cash to investors, and a lot of cash, when things go well. I think Canva as a story has educated capital in Australia. We benefit from a lot of superannuation funds now investing in Blackbird. And that's because they've been on the Canva journey, and they can see that when you do invest in a generational company right at the beginning and you invest in every round that they raise after that, it's an absolutely meaningful part of a sensible asset allocation strategy when you're managing billions of dollars on behalf of individual taxpayers, individual superannuitant contributors. And we have to tell that story in New Zealand. We're way behind in terms of investing in VC as an asset class. New Zealanders don't get exposure to our startups because we don't have participation from KiwiSaver funds for the most part in venture capital. There are a couple of good exceptions. And I think that's a huge opportunity. So something I'm really passionate about.
So that's really interesting. Like, the biggest difference between the New Zealand and the Australian economy is that they've had their version of KiwiSaver for 30 plus more years. And as a result, their economy is many, many times bigger than it should be on a per capita difference. And I mean, they've got iron ore as well, but you know, let's ignore that a little bit. But like, the sophistication of that market where their superannuation are investing all these different asset classes is a big part of the reason they're so much further ahead. Yet here we have like Simplicity. We'll call out the good people at Simplicity who've invested. We've got a few kind of like, you know, there are some little plays being made by some of the big kind of institutions, but it's tiny, right? As a percentage of what is allocated compared to best practice overseas or even just in Australia.
That's right. So I think something like 84%, don't quote me on that, of KiwiSaver funds are invested with the big four banks, and none of them invest in venture capital. They're not incentivized to. They don't run venture capital funds, so why would they pay someone else's fees? That's sort of the status quo for most New Zealanders. So you definitely can vote with your money and shift your KiwiSaver to, I would say, Generate, Booster and Simplicity are funds that do participate in venture capital. The impact of that is most Kiwis don't have any exposure to our high growth tech startups. Whereas they could have the opportunity to own a tiny bit of them. The other impact is that we just have way fewer funds available to tech founders in New Zealand. So in Australia, actually in 2019, New Zealand funds invested $43 million in startups. In 2022, that went to over $200 million. And that was largely thanks to Elevate, which we can talk about. But in Australia, in that same year, 2022, New Zealanders got $200 million. Australian founders got $7.7 billion. And the difference is largely superannuation fund participation, which has seeded this ecosystem, thriving ecosystem of venture capital funds, of which Blackbird was just one of the first, in the right place at the right time early on.
And Elevate is a government program that actually just put money into approved funds with a good track record and really good governance around them on the same terms as any other investor, but just to increase the pool of capital available for and the professionalisation of the sector. And that has invested, you know, with pretty good results so far in the scheme of government interventions and things, as opposed to prior things the government had done in the space that invested with far miserably below standard outcomes for the space. So it is a wild success so far compared to everything else the government has done. But the government is looking to can it.
Yeah. So I think it has been a success. The thing with venture is that it takes 10 years before you really know. But I would say the trajectory is good in terms of, if you think about Elevate's aims, the predominant aim, I believe, is to create a venture capital ecosystem, because we know that tech companies can't thrive unless they have some seed capital to get going. And we want tech companies to thrive because we need to shift New Zealand's GDP to away from primary industries to higher profitability industries that can be exported from New Zealand with much lower carbon emissions. And so if you think about the first aim of Elevate, it actually has been very successful, because if I take just Blackbird as an example, Elevate's participation allowed us to double our first fund, which meant that I got a job. I don't think I would have been, Blackbird couldn't have afforded to hire a third team member if they hadn't doubled the fund size. So, and Blackbird, as an example, has gone on, you know, every dollar that we invest from a Blackbird New Zealand fund actually is matched by another $1.40, so $2.40 in total impact, of other Blackbird funds. So we have a big $700 million follow-on fund that we invest in early stage Kiwi founders that are growing up. And because of other LPs, other investors that we've been able to attract to Blackbird New Zealand funds, especially our second fund, we've maximized the impact of Elevate's money. And of course, we are working super hard to make Elevate's money return many, many times over. My life's work is building Blackbird to hopefully great success. And if I'm successful, Elevate is successful as much as, you know, my parents that invested in the fund, or any Aussie superannuation fund that invested.
Yeah, and unlike so many of the prior things, it's actually trying to make a return for New Zealand Inc. Because instead of kind of spraying money into the void, which I think was the previous policy, and I mean, there is very fair reservations around government ability to do this well, because it has been done very poorly for a long time prior. But Elevate is actually trying to invest to make a return that can then be recycled back into whatever the government wants, as opposed to some of these other kind of programs. It seems to me absolutely bananas when we've already got the structural fund deficit to then pull out, you know, what is actually quite sensible investment.
Yeah, the challenge is that it was set up by the Labor government, so that's never going to be popular. And there is an ask of funds up front. Obviously, you're making an investment and you hope to get that investment back, but it does have a long time horizon. And I understand that. But it seems a little hypocritical to be so pro-tech and so pro-innovation and yet pull the plug from the main source of energy and dollars into the ecosystem. I think we're not, maybe the point to say as well is this is not a forever strategy, but we're probably about halfway to where we need to be to have a thriving capital ecosystem that can stand on its own 2 feet. There are a couple of other changes we can make, like to incentivize KiwiSaver funds to diversify into VC.
Yeah, and sorry, just to interrupt you there. Like, and when we say KiwiSaver funds to diversify into VC, we're talking about international best practice, which would be a couple of percent of your entire funds under management, up to about 10% in anything that's alternative to the normal stocks and bonds or whatever. So it's like a small allocation of those funds rather than kind of, hey, let's put it all on red.
Totally. Yeah, it's a part of the balanced portfolio approach. And as you say, it's absolutely best practice, not very normal in every other market in the world. Any of the large endowments in Canada, Australia, the US pursue a similar strategy. So it's absolutely nothing new under the sun. But for some reason, I think just because of lack of competition and lack of incentive, KiwiSaver funds, particularly run by the big four banks, don't bother.
It's wild. It's really disappointing. And it's been cool to see the advocacy you've been leading there. Great open letter to the ministers responsible that people can find online. And yeah, I really hope I really hope it works out. As someone who works a little in venture capital, who works with venture capital-backed funds, who works with venture capital-backed companies, I'm obviously wildly compromised, but I'm a big fan.
It's probably worth saying that it's not going to change our commitment to New Zealand whether Elevate exists or not. We're lucky to have the backing of deep-pocketed international funds, but it will mean that if we are really successful and we do our job properly, which is to invest in the best Kiwi companies, our ownership stake is pretty much all owned by Australians. Do we want Kiwi ownership of these companies or not? And Elevate is probably the most efficient, elegant vehicle to make that happen.
Whoa, we hadn't tried the who made Pavlova approach. That's a great approach.
I'm talking Farlap. I'm talking Pavlova.
Let's do that. And let's jump quickly into like what makes a good founder. As I think a lot of the times that people who aren't deep inside the world of VC see VC-backed founders is when things go extremely well or extremely badly. And so everyone will have a Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes kind of everyone will have a WeWork or an Uber, you know, being assholes kind of approach, you know, picture in their head of big VC. And then in the local context, you'll see people when they kind of flame out or, you know. So what does it take to be a great founder? Because you do have to kind of, from my observations so far, be a little bit delusional, right? But just the right amount of delusional. You've got to be delusional to believe that you can, you know, make a new billion-dollar business and knock off the incumbents, but not so delusional that you aren't a good and kind and reasonable human that people would want to work with and can be a responsible steward of money. So that's a pretty fine line to run.
Yeah, I think Sam talks about New Zealand being a Galapagos island of founders, where Kiwi founders are unique and different compared to what you might see in Silicon Valley or Australia. Your typical Kiwi founder that we invest in is probably doing it for the first time. They've probably never built a company before and certainly never a technology startup. They usually come to it because they get obsessed with a problem that they might have come across in their personal life or their home life or through some work that they've done. And they really believe they've got some way of solving that problem that other people haven't thought about, and they really want to solve it all the way to the end. Those are great conditions for building a tech startup. People probably think that founders would get into this role to make money. There are so much easier ways to make money, property being one example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so people really don't do it for the money, and we don't invest in people really who are on that track or motivated in that way. I would say we tend to invest in people who are super motivated by the customer problem. So their customer could be, let's take Craig from Holter. He came across the idea from Holter because it combined a couple of things. He'd grown up on a dairy farm. He'd saw his parents working 100-hour weeks. He had gone to engineering school and worked at Rocket Lab. So he saw that small, very focused teams could achieve something from nothing. And he kind of brought these threads together to found Holter when he was only 23. That's a great example. Someone doing their life's work. They have their parents in mind every day they go to work. They have a really novel idea for how to solve those people's problems. In the case of Holter, it's putting smart collars on cows, which allow you to do everything from fence them virtually, stop them peeing in waterways, make sure they're eating the grass you want them to eat, understanding their core health metrics, getting them to the milking shed without needing dogs or a quad bike to do that. And so true life's work, deep customer obsession, and he could build the product because he was an engineer. He knew what it would take, and he could talk even on day one about what the product would be 5 years, 10 years from now. He's an exceptional person.
He is exceptional, and also had been exposed to excellence where, I mean, we are Galapagos Islands, but luckily we've had 1.5 cycles of excellence, right? So Rocket Lab's already spitting out so many great things. Holter is now spitting out great things. You know, and Australia's probably 3 cycles ahead of us. But, like, I think that exposure to excellence and ambition is such a key part of it as well, hey?
That's right. It's such an exciting time to be investing in New Zealand because we are, as you say, we're probably 1.5 cycles in. And I can see from my Australian colleagues and the sort of investments that we're making over there, we're really 3 generations in. People have worked at Atlassian or Canva and then something else, and then now they're becoming founders themselves. I think the other things that can make amazing founders, though, customer obsession and empathy for the customer is absolutely something that would describe all of the founders we've invested in. Then you have other founders who really spike on building amazing teams. We give founders money so they can hire other people. And so something that kind of determines success is the ability for someone to magnetize other amazing people to their mission and grow a team that ultimately will be probably thousands of people strong. So someone like Connor from Tracksuit is a real magpie for talent and a magnet for talent. And Tracksuit's unfair advantage, the product is really good, they really understand the customer need, but really what's making that company exceptional is the ability to grow the team, not just here, but overseas as well. So I think founders can spike in different areas. You've spoken to David from Vivi on this podcast recently. He is the customer for his product, and he's just so deep with fandom, building a product that people love, and so he really spikes there. Lauren from Multitudes probably she was led to build that company from her work in diversity, equity, and inclusion, but she's also was a former Bain consultant, so she kind of knows how to set a really compelling strategy, knows how to build a team. And so I think people have different spikes.
What are you optimistic about? Because I think, you know, the world's always ending, but there do seem to be, you know, a bunch of macro things that are not that cool happening in the world. But then the venture capital space, there is so much excitement. The things I'm seeing in decarbonization, where there's so much energy. Like the things that you see if you're lucky enough to work in and around VC, it feels like you live in a different world than when you turn on the news, right?
That's so true. First of all, I don't really read the news. Would recommend that if you want to have good mental health.
Get out of it.
And try and instead spend that time learning, reading deeply about something rather than sort of reading the headlines.
You read week-long or month-long cycle media, not day media.
Yes. And I feel, incredibly optimistic about the ability for technology innovation to improve the world that we live in now more than ever and from this part of the world. The ability of a founder now to build a world-changing company from New Zealand is, 100 times greater than 10 years ago because of cloud distribution of software, the availability of capital and interest from really big, deep-pocketed funds, later-stage funds for big ideas. You know, we invested in a Māori founder, Ratu Mataita, who founded OpenStar, which is a novel approach to nuclear fusion. And I think that just epitomizes the moment. You know, like there wasn't really any nuclear expertise in New Zealand. There isn't really any nuclear expertise in New Zealand thanks to our anti-nuclear stance. But on the fusion side, his background came from understanding superconducting magnets, which is an area of research expertise at the Robinson Institute. And his ability to first raise money for that very wacky, could be a $100 billion company, could well be a $0 company in a few years' time. He wouldn't have been able to raise money 5 years ago from any of the VC funds here. And nor perhaps would he have been able to, or will he be able to grow the company to the scale that it needs to be if it's successful. And so there's a real moment now that raised ambition. I think Rocket Lab actually does have a lot to do with that, especially on the deep tech side, showing that it's possible to have a big idea, pursue it at all costs, and build a globally relevant company from New Zealand with New Zealand science.
Rocket Lab is my favorite example of that in that, I mean, I've used this example on the podcast before, but I sat in a webinar with a really great US, advisor talking about the New Zealand startup scene. And he said, New Zealand should stick to what it's good at, agriculture, bit of SaaS fintech and space. And it was like, well, if you'd said that 5 years ago before Rocket Lab, it would have been insane to say we're good at space, you know, like great and extraordinary things like OpenStar can come from this country, even if we don't have, the long history in them, right?
And that is the most fun thing about my job. Mm. We are not specialist investors because the two or three or five founding teams that we think matter per year could be building in any area. So our recent investments, as you know, OpenStar, Nuclear Fusion, Kiki, short-term rental, similar to Airbnb. Vivi's one from a while back. Digital Collectibles, I mean, you couldn't say in advance where are we gonna invest in 2024 or 2025, and that's one of the really fun things, and certainly makes my job tough in a good way to get up to speed with each of those topics as they come across my desk.
I'm sorry we've gone long. I've really enjoyed chatting. A couple of last little questions. What would your advice be to someone wanting to get in the space? Because one thing we haven't covered is how much stuff Blackbird does do to create pathways into the space. And it could be really cool just to mention, you mentioned briefly the fellowships, but yeah, things like StartMate and the community that Blackbird is a big contributor to, things like Giants, things like Sunrise. You know, there's a lot of work that is done by, you know, lots of people in the VC ecosystem, but Blackbird is the, you know, big contributor to help people get amongst.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we only make a few investments a year. So we only get to directly interact with a few founding teams and invest millions of dollars in those teams. But we believe deeply that there's a, you know, the startup ecosystem should be 10 times bigger than it is. Joel, who created Sunrise, which is our festival of startups, made the point recently that there are more people employed at Bunnings in Australia than there are employed in startups. And so there's just such a big opportunity for people to find that they can do mission-aligned work, do really high-impact work in small teams, and achieve the things that they want to achieve with their lives. One thing we invest a lot in then is storytelling. So through Sunrise, which is this festival, we're running a two-day version in Sydney in May, and then there'll be a one-day version in Wellington in November this year. That is really all about bringing together people who are interested in startups, maybe people who work for them, who are thinking of founding one, who currently found them, who support them, whether they're lawyers or finance people around the ecosystem, and just to tell stories of true founder stories, the highs, the lows, and inspire people to get involved in the sector. We have a podcast, Wild Hearts, where we tell the stories of our founders for similar reasons. The other areas we're investing a lot for us is about bringing people together. We believe founders and their teams need community more than they need advice. So we try and bring groups of people together for serendipity to unfold. So that might be later stage founders who've got teams of 50 or more people, have similar problems, bring them together in a small open space. It might be bringing together head of operations people from our portfolio and outside to jam on what is top of mind for them. The other thing that we're investing a lot in is building Blackbird abroad. So we're doing a lot of brand awareness, building events in San Francisco, New York, and London, because we know that our network, which is already broad but could be deeper in those markets, is massively important for finding Aussies and Kiwis that are building companies in those markets, but also bringing expertise to bear for our portfolio.
So cool. And as a final thought, what will success be for you and your work at Blackbird?
For me, success is shifting New Zealand's GDP to be much more focused on innovation and enriching all of New Zealand so that we can afford to pay for a much better health system, better infrastructure, all the things that we all want, and there's never enough money to pay for. We should be a richer country than we are, and I believe that tech startups are the most efficient path to change that. And then personally, for me, it's about enabling amazing, wild-hearted founders to do what they do best and to raise their ambition at every turn. And so for me, it's about being a small supporter on those founders' journeys and proving that Kiwi founders can take on the world and that Kiwi venture capital funds can be great investments.
Yeah, love it. Well, congratulations on the leadership of Blackbird Aotearoa that you're stepping into. Can't wait to see what you do next. And thank you so much for the time and sharing your story so far today. That's Phoebe Harrop of Blackbird.
Kia ora, Simon.
Kia ora. Thank you so much to Phoebe. Thank you so much to you for having us along in your ears, and to everyone who helps make this happen, like our producer, Te Aihe Butler. If you do like what we do, please do rate and leave a review. It really does help. E no hora.
From the Spin-Off Podcast Network, that was Business is Boring, brought to you by Spark Lab. Make sure you're following Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information on SparkLab, visit sparklab.co.nz.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.